Welcome back to Looks Like New, a radio podcast for the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Kadala Burrows, a research fellow at MedLab, and this is a show where we ask old questions about new technology. On today's episode of Looks Like New, I am honored to be joined by Atasha Womack, a multi-hyphenate author, filmmaker, and independent scholar whose work has become a cornerstone for how we understand the intersection of Black culture, technology, and the future. Atasha is perhaps best known for her seminal book, Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, which continues to serve as one of the most important texts for understanding this global movement and philosophy that has gripped the world. However, her work is far more than just theoretical. Whether through her films, her fiction, her dance workshops and musical experiences, or her latest book, The Afrofuturist Evolution, which includes written exercise and reflection activities, Atasha continually articulates a vision of Afrofuturism that is based in an active world-building praxis that we can use to navigate and dismantle the oppressive systems of the present. Her recent work pushes the boundaries of the term Afrofuturism itself, moving beyond linear timelines and chromaesthetics into the realms of quantum physics, ancient cosmologies, and the multiverse as a site for liberation. In a world where we are increasingly grappling with the ethics of AI and the rise of techno-feudalism, Atasha's voice is a vital reminder that technology is not just about silicon and code. It's about the stories we tell, the ways we organize, and the imagination we deploy to reclaim our humanity. In today's conversation, we're going to dive deep into the evolution of her thinking. We'll discuss what it means to live in the future predicted by Octavia Butler. We'll explore the fantastical racism appearing in modern AI discourse. And we'll look at how ancient technologies like talking drums and Asante horns can help us build more equitable systems today. I am so incredibly honored and excited to be having this conversation. So without much further ado, Atasha, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Looks Like New.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here and be in conversation with you.
Thank you. Thank you. So let's just jump right into it. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the term Afrofuturism, how exactly would you define it? And in light of your recent book, The Afrofuturist Evolution, how would you define it now versus how you define it, let's say, 10 years ago?
Great question. Well, when I first wrote the book, Afrofuturism, The World of Black Sci-Fi and Fantasy Culture, I laid out a general framework, which was it's a way of thinking about the future that intersects imagination, liberation, technology, and mysticism. And I spoke very much about that. And now what I like to remind people is that all cultures have a relationship to space and time. And we have philosophies about what that means. And how we experience time. And a lot of those ideas are really expressed through how people engage with one another, linguistics, takes on the imagination, takes on reality. It's expressed through dance. It's expressed through music. Very few people will say, this is my relationship to space and time. But if you talk about their thoughts about ancestors or their thoughts about life and how it functions or music and how they count music, you know, the beats and rhythms in it. As people are talking about these things, they're essentially talking about space-time relationships. So the new book really drills down on that and focuses on four dynamics. It focuses on space-time relationships. It focuses on narrative storytelling, and it focuses on the imagination. And so just generally speaking, we're really looking at these elements as practice, as opposed to just purely explaining what Afrofuturism is and how people can engage with it. We're also talking about how other people in the past have utilized it, these space-time relationships or looking at nonlinear narrative or their takes on the imagination, their takes on dance. I have a whole section on dance and rhythm. and how they built upon these concepts that expand on our relationship to how we engage with the world. And all of this is coming from the standpoint of valuing humanity. So some of the new book is about how you can hone your Afrofuturist lens.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Yeah, I can definitely feel that, particularly in like one of my favorite parts of the book is the fact that you now included these like exercises and reflection, like questions for reflection in a way that makes it feel like something that we can take ownership of and employ in our day-to-day lives, you know? I think another evolution within this book from the previous one is it feels a lot more personal. You know, it feels like this one is really grounded in your lived experience. And it was really interesting to learn a lot more about your own personal history through this book. Could you speak a little bit to what inspired you to take that direction with this text?
Sure. Well, when I wrote the first book, and I talk about this a little bit in some of the opening chapters, I was approaching it initially as a journalist, you know, researching a subject and sharing it with people. I felt like Afrofuturism was something I had a relationship to. But in the midst of writing it, I realized I was, in fact, an Afrofuturist. And that came through the story concept that evolved into Rayla 2212 in that series. So this experience of writing about this woman on a future planet and her, you know, going into, you know, dealing with reincarnation and space travel was a transformative one for me. And that was really a sort of genesis of realizing that Afrofuturist theory is also related to these creative practices. It's not just analyzing a story, but writing a story of the future. It's not just, you know, your takes on the works of a John or Alice Coltrane, but it could be you actually creating music or moving to this music and the insights that you gain from it. So, you know, in the past several years, I've done a lot of talks on Afrofuturism and a lot of creative work on Afrofuturism. And there's a lot of, you're informed and transformed by these creations as much as you are from the contemplations. And that kind of transformation makes you look at moments in your life a little differently. And I think what I wanted to relay with this book was that there is an evolution in this experience of thinking about space-time and rhythm and delving into these works, the music works or the dance works or the literature that so many people have created over time. And then creating some works yourself does, in fact, help to immerse one in these processes. And I think for me, it really came about because I remembered doing a lecture at Clark Atlanta, and I talked a little bit about this in the book too. And there was someone in the room who thought that these conversations about futures and Black people in the futures was just kind of wishful thinking. Like, you know, and it had something to do with looking at W.B. Du Bois and some of the short story work he did and saying, oh, wow, you know, he was thinking about these ideas in the past. And you're like, okay, yeah, true. He's thinking about these ideas in the past. But as one is writing about futures and contemplating them, they are, in fact, transforming those futures. Mm-hmm. They are experiencing some sort of heightened dynamic. And, you know, so Afrofuturism isn't just talking about what you would like to see in the great by and by, like it's this distant heaven you will one day get to. It's also about thinking, working through, you know, the life, love, and community that you create in the moment and the space of growth and love that emanates from it as a result. That's a present experience. So if I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, what the future could look like and what sustainable energy could look like 100 years from now, And I give, you know, any kind of thought to that, that's really changing how I'm thinking about what I'm doing now, especially if I take any sort of action, small or large, to in some way bring that future about, that's transforming me now. And then there's other things. It's not always an act of contemplation. You know, again, I love dance. So some of my earliest Afrofuturist engagements had to do with, okay, I'm dancing to music and I'm moving in space and time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, many of us have been in spaces, you know, house music culture, other kinds of music, and you're excited and you're moving to it. And, you know, you become this joy generator. Mm-hmm. But that could become an elevated experience too. That could feel very transcendent. Sometimes people, you know, they associate that with a spiritual experience that has some cosmology associated with it. And sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's coming from other spaces, but you know, the point of it is that you experience the future now as you engage with it. So if you have hopeful futures, you are in some way experiencing that in the present. If you have a concept of dire futures, you are experiencing that in the present. It changes the actions you take and don't take now.
Totally, totally. I think that there's something really beautiful there about thinking about how Afrofuturism in some ways is commenting on our present. You know, one of the mothers of Afrofuturism that we can think of is Octavia Butler, right? And she very famously talked about how the way that we make science fiction or create speculative fiction is in many ways a reflection of what we're experiencing right now. You know, Sam Delaney said stuff to the same effect. And I've been thinking a lot about how 2024 is the beginning of Parable of the Sower, right? And Parable of the Sower is this incredibly prophetic book where, you know, the California is like on fire with wildfires, and there's a right wing like ethno-fascist who runs for president under the slogan "Make America Great Again," right? And so now we, in our present moment, have transitioned, or we're in the process of transitioning from this great Afrofuturist book existing in the future to being our present. And in some respects, if we look at like the very beginning of the book, even a part of our past. So I'm wondering, now that we're like living in this Afro future that has been predicted by these great Afrofuturists of the past, like how does that change the role of us as Afrofuturists today? What impact does us transitioning into this this future that has been predicted, how does that impact the way that we move throughout this world?
Well, I would probably make an argument that, you know, the elements of Parable and the Sower weren't necessarily explicitly a commentary of now. It was also a commentary of her present, you know, and looking at threads of history, you know, looking at these moments and saying, hey, if there's not a course correction, these are things that could evolve. You know, she's commenting on, I mean, you had wildfires in California in a lot of different periods. You've had, you know, this talk about dehumanizing people. Some of the phrases that she was pulling from, you know, were pulling from campaigns of that period. I think, you know, the culmination and the heightening of it, some of it that we might feel connects to the present, is also someone just sort of looking at a set of patterns and making a story prediction. But that particular tale is not the Afrofuture, mm-hmm. right? That's a stream of time that someone wrote about in a story, probably in part as a warning tale, probably in part not that. There are other tales and other stories that also transform and speak to today as well. So one of the things I talk about in the Afrofuturist Evolution is just this power of the imagination. And really this holding of an imaginative space of joy and love and freedom, and sort of this shared context of humanity that one embodies and how they see things now, cultivating the sort of spirit of optimism or resilience even. And, you know, sometimes the task is a little easier when everything seems to be going great. Yeah. But it's a bit more of a challenge when things aren't. But it doesn't make it any less potent or possible or essential for the moment to be able to see that and see it so clearly that you, in some ways, big or small, experience it in the present. That's essential as well. So I would sort of present that as sort of a counterpoint. Yeah, there's a lot of things we can look at and we could say, okay, all is over. And then there's a lot of things you could look at and you could say, wait, there's possibilities for growth and transition and ebullience. The reason it's so important to cultivate that perspective is that if you don't see it, you don't take actions towards it. And you can reinforce a future that you don't want by expecting it and kind of capitulating to, you know, a future that dehumanizes people because, you know, other entities might find that more advantageous for whatever their means and ends are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a really great point. It's kind of like creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of some sort of dystopia, right? It's one of the risks of giving in or allowing ourselves to exist inside of somebody else's future or idea of what the future should or can.
Well, the thing is, you know, we talk about this in the book, like, what would you like to see? And then you work backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, the same way people who come up with these really problematic features, they come up with what they want to see and work backwards. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you come up with what you want to see and work backwards from that. What I find interesting, and I think I mentioned this in the book too, is that, you know, sometimes I might engage with some college students and, you know, you say, imagine a future that values humanity, one that you think would be really great, you know, where we're valuing the earth and we're valuing people. And sometimes, you know, I talk to students, they have a really tough time and they can imagine, they'll write out something they think should exist, but then they wrestle with, well, if I think about this too much and it doesn't happen, then, you know, it's a problem or it'll make me really sad. And you're like, well, how is it going to take place if you don't accept that it's possible?
Right, right. I think that leads me to another question. I mean, do you think that there's space for the coexistence of Afrofuturism and like Afro-pessimism? Do you think that it's possible for people to create Afrofuturist stories that are looking at dystopia or looking at like ways that things could go poorly in order to help create awareness so that we divert and move in another direction? Or do you think that in order for something to be Afrofuturist, it has to have a particular optimism or a hope that we get to the thing that is being depicted?
I think having a hope that you get there is important and essential. In storytelling, people are going to do a lot of things, right? For a host of different reasons. I think pushing to seeing how you can reach the goal is grand. Now, you know, but that has no bearing on what kind of story a person wants to tell. Mm-hmm. You know, but I do think that just in our day-to-day lives, it's important to think about what we would like to see. Mm-hmm. Because the reality is we're always imagining something. You know, you're always imagining something, you know, it doesn't have to be fictional and fantastical. You know, some of the people listening at some point, you know, thought about what school they want to go to. Mm-hmm. And took some action to go there because they thought about that as a future space to be, and now they're there. You know, some people thought about a job they might want to have. You know, so there are a lot of things we think about. You thought about what you want to wear this morning.
Yeah, totally.
And so that's the imagination at work.
Yeah, yeah.
What we would think of as a more modest scale. So we use our imagination all the time. We just might be, you know, sometimes we're just regurgitating other things that people have already set out for us. We might be imagining things based on possibilities. You might be, you know, imagining things for a lot of different reasons. Are you stretching that imagination? You know, those are getting to interesting exercises. And what reinforces your belief that something's possible and that what lends itself to you taking that action? Mm-hmm. And those are things, you know, that are internal reflections. Some people, when I was talking to, you know, one of these students, and they were saying, well, they didn't want to think about things that were possible because, you know, then it wouldn't happen. I said, well, wouldn't you want to do things to help bring it about? And that was the muscle they had to work, that they could do something to help bring this about. And that I found relatively interesting. But, you know, we all have relationships to how we use the imagination or what our values are and why we value these things.
Yeah. There's a part of the Afrofuturist evolution that I really love, where you're talking about how we live in the results of people's imaginations, right? Like the clothes that I'm wearing were once in somebody's brain, and then they were designed on paper, and then they were made. And then the recipe that we're eating, somebody conceptualized that. And the couch that I'm sitting on, like, that is something right. that somebody designed. And I thought that was such a beautiful moment in the text of just like, wow, this is a really profound idea that we just completely take for granted so often, you know, that mm-hmm. everything around us in our like human constructed world was once the product of somebody's imagination who dared to dream that this thing could be real.
Well, yeah. And we are kind of co-creators in it because we bought the couch, mm-hmm. You're wearing the sweater.
Yeah. Totally.
You know, so at least co-creators and the experience that you're having with some of these items. So I think when you look at it in that way, it shifts you in some ways, you know. You might think a little differently, take slightly different actions, and realize that so much of what you feel has been here forever was created and someone gave some thought to it, or maybe they didn't give enough thought to it.
Yeah, I feel that. To me, one of the most important offerings of Afrofuturist evolution is the idea that Afrofuturism is not actually contingent on a specific orientation towards time, but that for millennia, Black speculative praxis has been rooted in an orientation towards multidimensionality. Early in the book, you quote Reginald Crosley saying, in the Dahomian and Haitian reality, we exist simultaneously in different dimensions or parallel universes, and we have consciousness also in both realities or dimensions. And so, like, this is a pretty big, heavy idea, right? I think for a long time, science fiction was kind of rooted in first space travel and then time travel, and like, now we are getting used to this idea of existing in multiple realities. So I was wondering if you could, you know, break this idea down a little bit for our listeners who might be having some trouble wrapping their minds around it.
Sure. Well, you know, many of us experience time, or, you know, time for us is a measurement of the infinite, right? It's a minute. It's an hour. It's 2 hours, right? It's 2 hours away from some previous point. So that's something I think, you know, a lot of us, you know, generally speaking, understand. How you experience that minute or that hour or that day, you know, is something different just from thinking about time. the idea that time is always moving forward is, you know, something that people, a lot of spaces generally experience on one level. But you also have this conversation about the spaces that you're in and how we experience those spaces. And there, you know, cosmologies and, you know, these beliefs that, yeah, there's this present space that we're in, and then there's another space where you can exist in the non-physical. And there's other theories about this, you know, from all kinds of paradigms, you know, mm-hmm. Christian, Budan, Islamic, you know, Santeria, et cetera. There's a lot of, you know, ideas about, is there more to this particular dimension that we're in? And these are like philosophical ideas, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, some would say there's the space that you're in. And then some would say that you existed in a non-physical form before you came to this earth, whether you came from baby land or heaven or wherever, right?
Yeah.
And then there's an idea that when you're not in this physical form, you know, there's groups that have a whole host of thoughts as to what happens next. Is that the end? Do you, you know, reincarnate and you come back? Do you go into another dimension that's similar to this one? And then you have spaces that would say, well, you're always, you know, other beliefs that say you're always engaging with entities that are in these other spaces, physical and non-physical. You know, and that's when you get into the ancestors conversation, the thought that ancestors, people who had passed on previously, they might not be in a physical body standing next to you, but you can access their presence because they are somewhere, mm-hmm. but not here. And groups have ideas about where that could be, whether they're, it's another dimension, whether it means they're in some actual physical plane once you go deep through the earth. You know, there's a lot of theories about this, but again, are philosophical. Mm-hmm. If you believe that they're guiding spirits that are, have these energies or this sense of consciousness that you can connect to, they exist somewhere in a non-physical form, or maybe they take on a physical form and are on this earth plane. Now, some of that is cosmology. Some of these cosmologies have turned into myths and stories. I'd like to remind people that, you know, when we talk about like Roman mythology, that was actually religions and beliefs at one point, mm-hmm. you know, which some people engage in, you know. And then there's other spaces where some of those stories didn't become myths. They became ways that people operate in the world. They stayed in that perspective. Mm-hmm. So the realm of things that I'm talking about are kind of philosophical, you know, how one engages with the world. So if you're part of a belief where you feel like there are ancestors and you can connect with them and that they're in some space in the great beyond and that you can access, if you feel there are spirit guides, if you feel that you are multidimensional and that these reincarnated lives that you have in this future or this past and be happening simultaneously, and you can interact with that too, those beliefs transform how you experience space and time and how you mm-hmm. just engage with the world. The same way that, you know, our kind of core physics changes how we engage with the world, right? How gravity, you know, an apple falls from a tree,
yeah.
you know, and it's the ground. We experience that in the same way that you can experience these beliefs in these cosmologies, whatever they are. That's something that you actually experience. Now, if you change your belief, maybe you experience something different. All of these things are what we, you know, have become the fodder for what is the human experience, right? Mm-hmm. But then in addition to that, you have science and these multiverse theories. Mm-hmm. And these multiverse theories, you know, some they have more proof for than others. They're working on them. But it does indicate that there's more than one universe. you know, if there's more than one universe, you know, and those theories vary. I had a chance to write about and really research those for a project called Naya and the Multiverse, that's currently running at the Adler Planetarium, which is a lot of fun, about a girl who's like science and she learns multiverse theory. But, you know, the Marvel Universe is made up of multiverse theory at this point, right? Yeah. And some of that is loosely based on something called the mini worlds theory, where there's this idea that every possibility or probability of anything that could ever happen to you or that you could experience splits off into its own timeline once the probability or the choice presents itself, which is, if you just take that, you know, talk about a platform for telling stories. But I think it's interesting because some of these multiverse theories mirror some of these older cosmologies about there just being other planes of existence, that you are. Now, the difference is, you know, the philosophies of, you know, some of these African cosmologies we mentioned, some of them would argue that you're engaging with these different realities in the present. Some of our scientific theories say you're not engaging with these things. So although the mini worlds theory says that the probability that, you know, different timelines split off every time a choice or an option presents itself, doesn't mean that you're interacting with it. But some of these cosmologies say differently. It makes for interesting reflection, but it does transform how you look at things in the moment.
Yeah, totally. Because it's also kind of like, it's one thing to say we are not interacting with these other dimensions, and another thing of saying we cannot interact with these other dimensions, right? Like, I can say I am physically here in Boulder, and that means that I am not interacting physically with people in DC, but that doesn't mean that I can't travel to DC at some point, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, on a smaller level, we, you know, beyond the cosmologies, we interact with a kind of interdimensionality all the time. You know, you and I are in two different cities and we're conversing. And in the moment, you know, at least you and I in this moment can see each other through a computer.
Yeah.
So that digital, so this exchange is happening through a medium.
Yeah. Totally.
When people are going to listen to this, they're going to listen to this in a moment where I'm not actually speaking. They'll be listening to a capture of this conversation, you know, some minutes, hours later. Mm-hmm. But it's a present experience for them, although it's something that already happened.
Yeah.
You know, so, and these are, you know, smaller things that we experience a lot. In the book, I talk about being on a phone call while I'm also checking text messages, and I'm in an airport, I'm about to get on a plane and travel, and then I'm also thinking about my family and some family event they're going to that I won't be at, but I can imagine it. You know, if I'm imagining the phone call and the person I'm talking to, and I'm also engaged on my, you know, texting somebody, I'm in that space, then I'm also in a transitory space, you know, physically, of I'm about to get on a plane and have an image of where I'm going. It's a place I've been before. I'm imagining that. And I'm also imagining this event that I'm not attending, that my family's going to, that I can't go to because I'm going somewhere else. I'm holding spaces for all these things in one moment.
Yeah.
How is that not interdimensional?
Definitely. And the ways that our identity shows up in these different spaces, it's like I am multiple people existing in different realities simultaneously. Like I have my emotional reality, I've got my physical reality, the reality of what's going on in my phone and all of the different profiles that I have and the way that I perform identity in different ways in these different spaces. I think that another really interesting part of this book is the way that you in the book include all of these really interesting illustrations and then also encourage the reader to think through their own mappings and schema of how they think about these things. And one of these like ways of mapping Afrofuturism that has been rattling around my brain for a while is this idea that like we are now becoming conscious of, even that is not really the right word to say now, but it seems like right now the sort of dominant idea within not just Afrofuturism, but science fiction in general is this sort of like fifth dimension, fifth order of Afrofuturism, where like if we think about traditional African spirituality and this unity and oneness between artistic practice and spirituality, where like me as a mask dancer, I'm not doing that so that my work can show up in some sort of gallery space and have, you know, an audience in like the way that we think about it in the West, but it's like an integral part of my spiritual health. There's like, to me, like this first dimension. And then when we think about sound and how integral sound is to Afrofuturism and the way that a sound is like a wave, to me, that's like a second dimension. And then when we think about like Sun Ra, Space is the Place, you know, thinking about like Star Trek and Nichelle Nichols, like this idea of space travel being this third dimension. We have Octavia Butler with her time traveling, and that's like fourth dimension. When we get into this fifth dimension, it's like this idea of the multiverse that is so prevalent at this particular moment, but also again, not just of this moment. When we think about like Anansi, and when we think about Eshu and the Yorubas and like Yoruba spirituality and the way that these different figures syncretize with each other in a way that shows that they are existing simultaneously in these different places and across time, that is a real multidimensional idea that has existed with us for really, really, really long time, you know? And so I guess this is a really long prelude to ask this question of like, how do we reconcile this idea of Afrofuturism not necessarily being only linked to time and only linked to the future and a relationship to time, but other schema for thinking about Afrofuturism with the name Afrofuturism, right? Like, do you think that there will ever be a time, or do you think that it would ever be necessary for us to use different language for talking about this larger phenomenon?
Yeah, well, I think people are in different ways. Mm-hmm. Afrofuturism puts a lot of it under one tent to see how it overlaps and influences, you know, one another. So, you know, there's Afrofuturism as genre, right? If you're talking mm-hmm. about certain, you know, what makes an Afrofuturist song or what makes an Afrofuturist novel. And then there's just the lives we live as we're engaging with space and time, and how we think about that. You know, someone asked me once, they said, well, what's the difference between Afrofuturism and African philosophy? Hmm. And I said, well, what it's tilted towards, you know, a broader sense of how we would talk about technology. But that's an interesting, you know, thing to think about when you're thinking about Afrofuturism, like not as like genre and artifacts, but like mm-hmm. just this way of thinking. You know, is it you're contemplating ways of thinking about these different African philosophies to some extent, you know, and how they apply in different environments or how one builds upon them, or even looking at what people have done around these thoughts, you know, especially we're in the West. So syncretization is the name of the game mm-hmm. on this side of things, whether it has a label or not. But living through these community interactions that are built upon a kind of synchronizing, whether you're conscious of it or not, puts one, I would say, in a pretty multidimensional space. I mean, sometimes when we make these parallels between African diasporic life and, say, cyborg metaphors, you know, it does parallel this idea that W.B. Du Bois talked about, he's talking about being African and American, but you could apply that to a lot of things. You know, it's being more than one thing and living in a space where there's you're always creating a harmony between things that are socialized to be incongruent. And yet you found harmony between these identities, and that's how you navigate the world, which is going to transform how you see things. Mm-hmm. And I think of these mosaics, I think of, like, you know, many people in their lives with this mosaic and this tapestry of things, and you're some of which you were sort of given or informs who you are, and some of which you collect along the way, and some of which you kind of release, and you're constantly creating or recreating, ideally, lives and experiences that are an amalgamation of a lot of different beliefs. Mm-hmm. That in some way, sometimes for our own lives, shape our own belief. But those become the tapestries of life. Mm-hmm. You know, in this present experience that we have, you know, the Sankofa idea, which always comes up when we're talking about Afrofuturism or Black life in general, is about this concept of you have to, how does one move forward?
Right.
You know, it's symbolized by a bird that's looking at an egg on its tail, but its feet are facing forward. Sometimes people describe it as, you know, to go back and get it, which, you know, in other ways, I think of it, you know, in this Afrofuturist way of, you know, really taking the best of the past and bringing it forward. It's a reminder. Sankofa is a reminder that in order to move forward, you need to kind of look at the past. Mm-hmm. And have some kind of relationship to it. And that can empower you to move forward in a way that's valuing the earth and humanity, if you're aware of these things that had happened before, and looking at what those tools are that you can build upon. And that's not just like this neat little idea. I think it kind of runs foundational to how a lot of people within the culture kind of operate.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. There's something that you mentioned towards the beginning of your answer there, where you pointed to this idea of, like, technoculture, right? Of, like, the relationship between Afrofuturism and Black technoculture. So I wanted to ask some questions around technology, right? Like, we're in a pretty interesting moment within our wider culture where there is this a new paradigm shift being brought about by a specific technology when we think about the development of AI, and also an interesting moment where our political systems are being captured by people who gained power originally through their ownership of specific technology corporations. And so it feels like we're experiencing a real shift that we can always say that technology plays a role in the way that things are changing, but this feels a little bit different to me, right? There's a particular moment in the Afrofuturist evolution where you talk a little bit about generative AI and about some of your early attempts with generating images and some of the disappointments that you experienced too. I'm thinking specifically of you're talking about trying to create a Black woman in an Arctic environment and how she still always was showing so much skin, and it's like, but it's cold, you know, it's not making sense. So I was wondering, do you think that generative AI has a role in Afrofuturist art or activist practice, or are there more, are you feeling more concerned about the way that things are developing in that area?
Yeah, it's funny. Some of the earliest conversations about Afrofuturism as it was becoming Afrofuturism, using that term anyway, was always these assessments and analysis of technology. And you would have some people who, and this is, you know, going back to, say, the 90s when the internet's becoming the internet. And, you know, you have cyber culture or cyberpunk and, you know, these cyber culture narratives, and you have the Matrix coming out. And so there are always these conversations about technology as being this great connector, you know, and it could be this sort of tool to really, you know, and help humanity. And then, you know, this conversation of, well, wait, you know, there's these other dynamics too that could be really problematic. Mm-hmm. And so those two dynamics always ran in tandem, mm-hmm. As an analysis or a question. And you know, there'd be people who say, you're holding up the future by wanting to have this conversation. Like, if we sit and stop and analyze all these things, how will we move into the glorious future? How will we, you know, make the money we're supposed to make or the change we're supposed to make? And, you know, there's all kinds of technologies, you know, in history you could go back to. And there's the promise, and then there's the challenge. Our cars are amazing. You know, they cause pollutants. And, you know, so you move into, you know, the current period, and, you know, the conversation, it still goes into the benefits, you know, on one level. And then this, you know, these challenges on another. What I'll say is something that a couple people have said before, and the, you know, and this is something to always think about in these periods, is what is it about the human experience that you value, that you would like to prioritize as something that you and community continue to do? And, you know, that can seem like a real basic question.
Well, I mean, but it feels like such a great way of approaching this, right? Because it seems like so many of the challenges or the reasons why there's so much backlash is like, we were promised a labor-saving technology that would give me back some time in my day so that I can make art and interact with my friends and, you know, explore myself. And instead we have longer hours and we work more. And as an artist, I'm getting paid less because somebody else is, you know, generating, you know. So I do think that question of like, what about the human experience do I want to preserve is such a beautiful framework for thinking about this, you know.
And what part is important to you? What part do you think is essential for humanity moving forward? And, you know, obviously there's tools and elements, you know, and all of this stuff that one could utilize. You know, how much of this is hurting the earth? Is there a resolve for that? Is there a way to do it where, you know, it doesn't have to, you know, cause, you know, these sorts of challenges? But I think that's something to really think about. What gets interesting is that usually there's such a race forward, that it's not always, you're not always encouraged to sit and think about that kind of thing. And, you know, people in spaces, there's something else that's prioritized. And you know, those are all things just to sort of contemplate. You know, are you your data?
Right.
And, you know, what relationship should you have to the data you generate? Whatever that is, it's the you know, the motion sensor, you know, where your finger moves on a phone, the sites you look at, your health data, you know, your motion, your movements, your physical movements. Is yeah. that private? Is that public? Is that, you know, is it a great exchange, you know, to swap those things for access to a technology that makes your work move a little faster or connect to the world? Is that a equal exchange? You know, is that something you're, you know, but these aren't things that we get to just sit and think about, you know, because as we're all putting this stuff together, something else might be prioritized. And even in our interactions as consumers, we might be prioritizing something else. Do we like being consumers?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you bring up a really beautiful point. I think, like, for me, a lot of my research is around this transition of our economy from capitalism to one that is based around data. And one of the things that I constantly come back to is this idea that one of the, like, philosophical I'm trying to figure out how to say this. One of the things that we don't often talk about when we talk about the Industrial Revolution and by extension the industrial slave trade is this philosophical problem that arises where a huge part of the trouble with the industrial slave trade is the idea that we as Black people were reduced to data, essentially, right? Where it's like we are no longer viewed as human beings, and instead we are viewed as the amount of, like, work hours that we can give somebody for free and the amount of money that we can generate for people, et cetera. And right now we are experiencing a similar situation with this new development of this, like, data economy, where we are constantly generating value and data for these large corporations in a way that we see no sort of returns from, or imagined returns, or returns that aren't even a fraction of what we are generating for these larger corporations, in a way that, you know, we are all being abstracted in this way. But it can feel tricky to talk about or make that sort of comparison, because there, it feels obviously less brutal than what we experienced during the slave trade, right? But there is a similar abstraction of being, and in which, like, we know from our own experiences that we are something greater than the composite of all of this information that exists about us. But more and more and more, we are being reduced to just these data points as an amalgamation of just, oh, where am I looking? What am I liking? What am I scrolling through? You know?
And what I would probably say is, like, to stretch the timeline and stretch the reference points, mm-hmm. you know, because you see the same elements in, you know, there's the Industrial Revolution piece, there's enslavement, there's, you know, the serfdom of, you know, old Europe, there's the, you know, there's a host of things, where people weren't valued for an array of reasons. Mm-hmm. And someone's benefiting from that kind of lack of value. But then there's also other examples of that not being the case, right? Mm-hmm. And what does that look like? You know, there's a book I'm thinking of right now, and I can give you the name for it later, but and it references how there's all kinds of, like, models for these societies in the past that people were a little closer to analyzing these times in early anthropology. You know, they hinted at, but they didn't go into, because, you know, sometimes they were busy trying to capture something else, you know, or, I don't know, prove the imbalances in worlds instead of just looking and observing mm-hmm. some stuff that was happening. But you had societies where the leadership model was something like, during the agrarian season, you know, this person's the leader. And when it's not, you know, the season for growth and harvesting, this other person, you know, then we don't have a leader. Or we operate in, as a council, or we operate as a collective. And, you know, so there have been moments and spaces and time where it wasn't about that. We've been in moments and spaces and worked with people where it wasn't just about what they could do for the collective, but just that we're all in this shared space. And creating value. So we know what that looks like and what that feels like. And, you know, my suggestion would just be to kind of think about what that looks like and feels like and how you build and expand upon that. You know, when we're talking about this, you know, who are you and the span of data collection, I think, you know, these spaces where you get to really sort of talk about this stuff becomes really important, or the spaces that you create to sustain whatever fulfills or gives you some level of joy and human connection can inform you around that.
I really appreciate your continued persistence in finding positive ways to think about these things and recognizing that it's not all lost, you know, that there are, in the same way that we have experienced moments of intense distress, there have been moments of intense joy and where we have done things very well, and we can learn from those moments too. I think there's a project that we have here at the Media Economies Design Lab that you might be interested in called Governance Ecologies, and then there's a subset of that called Governance Archaeology, where we have a database looking at various points in history, various societies throughout history who have integrated cooperative praxis into their larger like governing structures. And that might be an interesting reference for you for future
Sounds interesting. And you know, and even, like even beyond that, just the collectives that people kind of create. I mean, it's these things can give life and insight and help people to move forward.
Yeah. I do want to dial back a little bit to something that you had mentioned before about this idea of, as new technologies are evolving, thinking about what do we want to preserve about the human experience. I've been thinking a lot about this idea within our culture lately, where there's this growing trend online of people using these imagined slurs like clinker to describe AI and AI systems to kind of point at this problem within techno-feudalism. But it feels really sticky to me. It feels like a sort of performance of like a kind of fantastical racism where people are using these terms as an outlet for actual internalized racist ideas. And instead of like performing those, instead it's like, oh, I have like a new space. And so I'm wondering about what you think of the morality of our actions towards non-human or non-sentient beings. Like if there is something inherently wrong or immoral about sort of like vile behavior if it is not being directed towards another human, or if it's kind of like not that big of a deal because we're not enacting violence against other people.
Oh, you mean like if someone's on some sort of like chat-based AI and they're like calling the AI names, you mean like that?
Yeah, but I've also seen a lot of videos online lately where people will kind of like have these skits and stuff where they'll use these like manufactured slurs about AI in a way where they'll like perform a skit and it's like they are targeting these AI systems, and it's supposed to be like, oh, we have solidarity as human beings against this machine, the system. But to me, it reads differently for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting stuff, right? You go back to some of these early science fiction films and they're talking about the alien, you know, and the alien sometimes was a metaphor for actual people who just had, you know, different ways of living. And then you also have like the, you have the other kinds of science fiction films where you're looking at, you know, the robots are taking over, right? Technology is taking over, and, you know, oh no, it's the androids, you know? And so there's that sort of, you know, I think people just have to be cognizant of their relationship to otherness, you know, in any form. And they could, even if you're talking about something that's sentient and doesn't seem to be all that important, you know, I mean, you're just making a skit or whatever, you know, that's one thing. But, you know, just, we have to just be cognizant of our relationship to othering something, or projecting our issues on something else. You know, because that's a pattern that comes out of sometimes how people interact.
Yeah. I think that's a great way of putting that. that's a great answer. Yeah. One of my favorite parts of the book, and I believe I mentioned this before, is how you offer these amazing reflection exercises. So I wanted to end us off by asking you one of these.
All right, great. What are the reflection questions?
So one of them, pretty early into the book, imagine that you are appearing at or experiencing the worlds in Du Bois' Megascope, a device that can project and capture all times and places. What do you see, feel, or experience? What world appears before you? Describe this experience.
Oh, wow. I see a world where we know the stories of our lakes and our rivers and our oceans. We know the science stories, but we also know these more ancient stories and the lore that it helped facilitate serenity and understanding for people. I see a world where we value humanity, where we create care and systems that benefit, that help and uplift those who have the most challenges. I see a world where mental wellness is a central value and mental health is a priority. I see a world where we talk about the isms that we engage with in this moment to some extent as a thing of the past, and we're really proud of the way that we were able to move into a space of valuing mental wellness and mental health, and shared relationships to land and to one another. And I see a world where we value and understand our earth. And we recognize that we're on a shared plane on this earth in a universe. And we just develop, you know, practices where we can celebrate together and we can have joy. And we also value life. And we value community. We value reflection. And we're able to work harmoniously with one another. That's the world that I see.
Wow. That is such a beautiful answer. Thank you so much for sharing that answer. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciated getting to pick your brain a little bit. It was such a pleasure speaking with you today. Do you have any other work that's coming out or recently released that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes. Well, I'm always excited about the Afrofuturist evolution. But I also have a graphic novella coming out called Black Moon Ritual, which will be coming out at the end of February. It's my first graphic novel, and I think a lot of fun. Deals with a kid, Naki, who's coming into his own on an island. And it's an ode to sustainable energy. I think that you guys get a lot of intrigue from it. And it's a part of a broader set of pieces that are just about protopias. Protopia, that's a term that essentially means you're not a dystopia, you're not a utopia, but you are always working harmoniously towards futures that help elevate and environmental wellness on our earth.
Amazing. I can't wait to check it out.
Okay, thanks. And I have to thank you for being awesome. It's been such a delight being in conversation with you.
A show that asks old questions.
Thank you. Thank you. The feeling is definitely mutual.
Looks Like New comes to you from the Media and Economies Design Lab at University of Colorado Boulder. You can find us on the airwaves across Colorado's Front Range, on KGNU Community Radio, on the fourth Thursday of every month, and online at lookslikenew.net, or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month.